Day. Welcome back, Dr. Fogarty. This is our third installment with you and a discussion about EBFM. I appreciate you allowing us to jigger around the agenda. I think it made sense for the from the council's perspective to have those two agenda items happen before we devote the rest of the day to a discussion with you. So welcome.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman. I've learned that you have to go with the flow with the schedule, so I understand completely. The PDT would also like to express our appreciation to the council for your generous allotment of time over the last three meetings as we roll out the material that we provided to you at the end of last year in a white paper requested by the council dealing with the issue of moving towards ecosystem-based management. Here's a quick reprise of the issues we were asked at the end of 2008 by the council to actually begin to investigate the process for developing an ecosystem-based fishery management plan. Some of the timing was delayed by other pressing issues before the council, but we began in earnest about a year ago, and we drafted a white paper, as I mentioned, and provided to the council, giving a detailed blueprint of the main issues in moving towards ecosystem-based fishery management in this area. And so over the last couple of meetings, I've been able to lay out part of that with my colleague, Bob O'Boyle. Fortunately, Bob couldn't be with me here today, and he sends his regrets. But this time, we're going to really talk a little bit more about some of the details of implementation. Those of you who were here last time know that I spent most of the presentation on a key issue related to spatial processes and how important that is as a key element in moving towards ecosystem-based fishery management and why it's become increasingly important as we think about moving towards ecosystem-based management in general and in marine spatial planning. The idea, Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, is that at the next meeting you'll be asking for a sense of the council on the direction it would like to take in terms of this process. So, again, thank you very much for the chance to roll this out in a orderly fashion over the last three meetings. as I mentioned, I'm going to just bring a couple of slides from the last couple presentations just to provide some continuity. And one of the most important ones really is this recognition that with the National Ocean Policy having been established by the President in the summer of last year, things are beginning to move very rapidly. And you got a sense of this really with the discussions that revolved around some aspects of ecosystem-based management, and in particular the coupled issue of marine spatial planning, which is envisioned as a really principal tool in moving towards ecosystem-based management in this area. And as we all know from the presentations we had yesterday, that energy interests are really a driving factor in this, and it's quite important that we be ready to represent the interests of both the ecosystem in the sense of ecologically sensitive areas and also the fishing industry. And so this is really what we're trying to do. I'm not going to talk directly to any significant degree about coastal and marine spatial planning, but I will note that in your folder in the tab that relates to discussion on habitat related information, you'll see some information we've provided to help both the council and the regional office in responding to requests from BORMA for comments on some of the potential wind farm sites that are now under consideration. So it is a big issue for us, and we're very interested in helping as much as we can in this overall process to the council and to the regional office. One of the critical things that you'll find in virtually any definition of ecosystem-based management is the clear recognition that it's a place-based process, that it's really, as framed here in the NOAA strategic plan, a geographically specified process. All definitions that you'll find of ecosystem-based management will frame the problem in this way, and they'll also mention at least two other critical issues. One is our need to understand the interrelationships among the parts of the system and how systems are affected by external forces, including climate and human activities. And then finally, the critical recognition that we need to think about humans as an integral part of the ecosystem. So these are all parts of what we're considering as we move forward in thinking about how we might implement ecosystem-based fishery management, the remit here at the council, but ensuring that we do it in a way that's consistent, fully consistent, and can be folded into the ideas, the fundamental ideas of ecosystem-based management in general, which is really a cross-sectoral or a multi-sectoral look at the impacts and human uses of the ocean. There are a number of clear benefits, we think, the PDT thinks, to the council in adopting an ecosystem-based management strategy, ecosystem-based fishery management strategy. Among them are a number of different ways in which savings and efficiencies and benefits of efficiencies would occur. We're basically talking about trying to simplify management structures in general by ultimately moving towards a much smaller number of place-based management plans that are fully integrated for that defined ecological unit and replacing the more than three dozen individual plans that we now have between the New England Council, the Mid-Atlantic Council, and the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, to the extent that that's practicable. We also see a number of levels of efficiency in terms of the kinds of management strategies and rethinking the management strategies that would be employed, and then also efficiencies in the terms of the way the fishery can operate within an ecosystem context. When we think about really not so much a species or stock-oriented approach, but one that's more broadly based in terms of a defined ecological region. It'll also allow us to consider questions that are of direct interest to the council, including accounting for ecosystem constraints on rebuilding strategies, consideration of climate change and effects on productivity in the system overall, and then basically an opportunity to coordinate more closely with different and related management authorities. And then finally, with increased stewardship from broader participation among folks that are interested in and involved in ocean use patterns. I'm going to take a little bit of time to recap some important work that the council undertook starting in 2005 with leadership from Chad Demarest. There were a number of very important scoping sessions, and we haven't actually turned back to this topic in some time, but I wanted to just give you a sample of some of the kinds of questions that were asked in the course of these scoping sessions in New England and some of the attitudes that were expressed, because I think they're quite important in revealing in terms of moving forward in ecosystem-based management, fishery management. I'll refer you to the Fishery Management Council website in the ecosystems folder for more detail on these results, or you can also check with Chad, who's here, of course. I'm going to give you 10 examples of questions that were related just to set the stage. And here, one of the first that was asked of the attendees was, would fishery management be improved if fishing areas were defined by ecological characteristics? And 60% of the respondents answered yes to that question. 30% were unsure, and no said 10%. If we look at the question of how effective is current fisheries management for long-term health of the marine ecosystem, a total of 66% said it's either ineffective or highly ineffective in terms of how we're trying to operate when we think about this as from the perspective of maintaining long-term health of the marine ecosystem. So a fairly substantial fraction. I'm going to show you three different forms of a question that relate to year-round closures that have been implemented. And again, these are quite informative, I think. When asked if these large-scale year-round closures are beneficial to fishermen, 41% of the respondents said no. But when we look at it from a more ecosystem point of view, the respondents had quite different recognition of the importance of this. Here, 46% said yes, that it was important for preserving biodiversity. A little bit later, I'm going to turn to another question that related specifically to this idea of biodiversity. And then finally, when you ask the question, are they important for in their use for habitat protection, now 63% of the respondents said yes. So there's a recognition that although not everyone felt it was of direct benefit to from a straightforward fishery point of view, and presumably by that it means the yields that were obtained by the fishermen. When you delve into other areas that are more deeply related to ecosystem processes, there was a much clearer recognition of the importance of some of these management tools. And at the very end, we'll talk about issues that relate to management tools and spatial strategies, and of course, some of the things that Chad had to say just before the break were directly relevant to this issue as well. In terms of the issue of whether we need to restrict fishing if productivity decreases, and here we're really thinking about recognizing the interaction between changes, environmentally induced changes in productivity and fishing patterns, 53.6% answered yes to that question. So there is an understanding that we have to adjust our fishing strategies as the productivity patterns may change, and this is an issue that's particularly important when we think about climate-related issues. Does biodiversity contribute to a healthy fishery? Here, 68% of the respondents said yes. So that's a really important result in thinking about what we might really have embedded in terms of objectives for ecosystem-based fishery management. And we'll be turning back to this issue again shortly. There was a recognition that our current fishery management practices can have negative impacts on the marine ecosystem, with nearly 60% responding yes to the question of whether they have a negative impact. Another issue that comes right to the fore when we're dealing with ecosystem-based fishery management and more broadly, in fact, for ecosystem-based management, is the idea of trying to reconcile competing objectives overall, specifically with respect to the issue of trade-offs. And here, nearly 80% of the respondents said that we're not currently dealing with that. So in a straightforward fishery context, that means trade-offs can mean dealing with what happens when we impose a management strategy on one species or one group of species that has effects on others. So we're not explicitly taking those kinds of considerations into account. And one of the benefits of adopting an ecosystem-based fishery management strategy would, in fact, to be able to quite explicitly deal with that very issue. There was also, of course, a broad recognition that there are a number of non-fishing activities that negatively impact the marine ecosystem, with 76% expressing concern about these types of impacts. And here's really where the importance of ecosystem-based management in general really comes to the fore, because we'd be looking at the cumulative impacts of all different types of human activities in the ocean. So before I go on, I actually want to try, as we go on with this presentation, to frame the issues in ways that are quite familiar to the Council and dealing with issues that you quite routinely deal with. And one of these principal concepts that we'll be talking about is the concept of biological production. If we look at it from a single species point of view, as you currently do, one of the principal ways of thinking about productivity and production in general is a change in biomass. And that has, for an individual species or stock, have components that relate to, on the positive side of the ledger, increases in the population due to recruitment that come in each year, increases due to the growth of the fish, and then loss terms, including natural mortality and fishing mortality. In each of those terms, there are really important embedded ecosystem considerations. But in tropical fisheries management, we don't actually often explicitly recognize these. So if we're thinking about the issues that relate to growth, for example, the issues of the food supply that are available to the organisms is really a critical consideration overall in terms of that component. And that, in turn, is dependent on a lot of very fundamental ecological considerations. Similarly, there are quite a number of issues that relate to recruitment that run the gamut from predation on young fish, pre-recruit fish, to oceanographic conditions that affect where the eggs and larvae are distributed and so forth. Natural mortality is a very important component from an ecosystem point of view in looking at factors that relate to predation in particular. And then, of course, fishing mortality, the principal thing that in principle, or the thing that in principle we have control over as a fisheries management agency overall. But each of these really need to be cast within a broader ecosystem context, and to a very large degree, that's what we're trying to do as we move towards ecosystem-based fishery management, to be quite explicit about these things and not to assume that they're constant, because they are changing. All these ecological conditions that we're talking about that affect each of those elements really are changing over time, and we really want to be able to account for that. And we actually have the tools in order to do that. In terms of an issue that you're quite familiar with, again, in terms of reference points, I am going to try to frame some of what we say in an ecosystem point of view and translate the single species type of concepts that you're used to in reference points to either a full ecosystem perspective or a multi-species perspective overall. But you're quite used to dealing in one way or another with curves of this type, where we have changes in the fishing mortality rate on the x-axis and the catch rates that you'd expect on the y, with some sort of dome-shaped curve, with the peak of the curve representing the maximum sustainable yield in terms of the catch. So, again, it's an idea that you're used to thinking about in the context of single species management, and there's a corresponding level of fishing mortality that'll give that maximum. But these basic same kind of ideas can be translated into a broader ecosystem context. And in fact, one of the first ways that that was done was to look at aggregate groups of species on the Northeast Continental Shelf. And I'm showing a picture from a paper that appeared in 1976. In which an aggregate species production model was fit for all resources on the Northeast Continental Shelf, and one that was actually used in management under the International Commission for Northwest Atlantic Fisheries starting in 1973. So this idea of bringing in the aggregate production, and it's an issue that we'll talk about in a moment, was really to try to implicitly take into account the fact that you've got interactions, biological interactions among the species that we're dealing with, and also there are what are called technical interactions through bycatch. And this approach was intended to actually explicitly deal with collectively those two issues and fold them into the idea of an aggregate production function. So we actually have been there before in some ways, albeit in a quite simple way, and we're in a position now to actually increase both the precision and the analytical capabilities to bring to bear on this problem overall. So we recognize that in moving towards a full ecosystem-based fishery management approach, we actually need a well-defined transition strategy, and we're proposing a particular one in our white paper to the council that basically starts from the recognition that right now we have quite a number of individual FMPs, some of course which deal with multiple species, but even in that context we're not generally thinking about interactions among those species, certainly not in a biological way through competition or predation. But we have these separate management plans, and we're not explicitly taking into account these important biological and fishery-related interactions. And generally speaking, there's not a direct consideration of the ecosystems within which these species or stocks occurred. So one of the things we'd like to do first is to place our current management plans in the context of the ecosystems in which they occur, and then begin a transition process, as I'll describe in a moment, that actually begins to look more formally at the interactions among the plans and the species covered by the plans. So basically, we're going to, in this hypothetical case, we've got a two ecosystem system, and now we've actually begun to place the plans within an ecosystem context overall. The transition strategy that we recommend here next is to begin a very formal process and a systematic process of looking at the interactions among the species and the fisheries and taking these into account, perhaps through the Ecosystem Community or Committee or a revived Ecosystem Committee by the Council charged with that responsibility, and also at the same time begin to directly account for climate and environmental effects. You'll recognize that a number of these kinds of considerations are in play currently. In fact, as we speak, there is a work underway with winter flounder assessments that are trying to bring directly to bear understanding on the changes in temperature patterns in the species. That would correspond to this idea of bringing in climate and environmental effects. You'll know, for example, too, that we are looking at some levels of interactions among the plans with the kinds of effects on forage fish that need to be taken into account and so on. So there is this work underway now. We propose to formalize that and deal with it in a much more systematic fashion. But we're also recognizing that ultimately, if we try to keep on layering complexity into these individual plans, finally they're going to collapse under their own weight. And so the things that we learn from this transition strategy will be quite important. But where we really want to get to are these ecosystem-based fishery management plans. And so here representing the different the two ecosystems, the two hypothetical ecosystems that I talked about, and we would replace these large number of individual plans that we currently deal with a much smaller number of integrated management plans for these regions. And these will basically directly or indirectly cover all the species in the system. So we'd really be interested now in broadening our view to make sure that species that are either target species in a fishery or non-target species, marine mammals and other species and other types of vulnerable species are brought directly under the umbrella of a single plan. And that's really where we'd like to get to. And what we'd like to do is to try to lay out the strategy for actually taking these next steps. So there's sort of a roadmap that we've developed that comprises eight steps to actually get to where we need to be for ecosystem-based fishery management. I'm going to deal with each of these in turn. But the idea here really is to actually go from the conceptual basis and the ideas that are laid out in very broad-based descriptions of what we mean by ecosystem-based management to a set of concrete steps that we can actually follow and implement. So that's what we're going to try to do. And one of the first and really important ones that the Council will have to deal with is this critical one of defining really what we want to achieve in terms of objectives for ecosystem-based fishery management. And we've thought about this in terms of two levels. One is sort of a high-level conceptual framework where we sort of set a vision for where we want to go and why we want to apply ecosystem-based fishery management and ultimately ecosystem-based management writ large. And then finally, a number of lower-level operational objectives, and these might involve the use of indicators and, in particular, the use of ecosystem reference points that are really meant to meet specific objectives overall. The box diagram that you see there really, and I recognize that not everyone will be able to read this, but it points out key issues that relate to some of the factors we've already discussed, such as the importance of preserving ecosystem structure and function, basically in terms of preserving biodiversity and a number of other issues. We do recognize that we need to work more closely with the socioeconomic communities to actually bring more fully to bear some of the objectives that we would have with explicit social and economic objectives for the overall plan. And this is really a quite critical issue, and I'll turn to that again at the end of this presentation. This issue I've talked about in detail, as I mentioned before, so I'm not going to go into detail here in this presentation. But essentially what we've done is an analysis looking at patterns of ecological productivity that relate to very fundamental physical characteristics and also basic food web characteristics at the base of the food chain, the food web overall, that define a number of discrete and large-scale potential spatial management units for us to consider. In our analysis, we find that there are four major areas that we recognize on the Northeast Continental Shelf, one of which was almost exclusively in Canadian waters in the dark blue and the Scotian Shelf, but extending into down East Maine area, which is known to have some strong affinities with some of the Canadian water mass characteristics and ecological characteristics, the central Gulf of Maine in the light green, Georges Bank, Nantucket Shoals in red, and the Mid-Atlantic region in blue. In the course of this analysis, we also found that there's some really important considerations that come to play in a number of different ways for the information on the shelf break. And that white designation right along the shelf break and extending out to the 200-meter isobath, we recognize as being related to the adjacent shelf areas, both on Georges and in the Mid-Atlantic, but also carrying some important and separate considerations, and not least of which are the occurrence and importance of a number of quite vulnerable species in those areas. Similarly, we find in the immediate nearshore areas in both the Mid-Atlantic Bight and in the Gulf of Maine, another important set of considerations that come into play in these nearshore areas. And again, they could be important areas to consider special consideration overall in the management strategy. So an important thing to consider and to recognize as we propose the potential use of these larger scale areas is one that we want to think about this as a spatially nested process. We're not thinking about these areas as closed in any sense. We know there are interconnections among them, both oceanographically and because of the movement patterns of the species involved overall. And most importantly, by saying we're thinking about larger scale potential management units, we're not saying that finer scale spatial processes are not important, but rather that we need a different context and a nested context within which to bring some of these finer scale processes to bear. But essentially, if something like this were to be adopted, we'd have basically in U.S. waters principally three major regions where we'd be looking to prepare integrated management plans for, from that perspective. This will give you an idea of how the areas that we're talking about correspond to some of the major stock boundary areas that are often used, although there are quite a few variations on the theme overall, but the black rectangles that you see, polygons that you see, represent the boundaries that are often used. For example, this is the one for Georges Bank that's typically used. And you can see that it extends into the deep water area adjacent to Georges in the Gulf of Maine. We find, actually, of course, a much higher correspondence when we look at the performance of both our proposed management areas and the way the fishing patterns occur that are actually much more closely aligned with the areas that we're proposing overall. But basically there you can see in the lower part the Mid-Atlantic region, a smaller region for the southern New England area that's sometimes designated, most often perhaps in conjunction with the Georges Bank one, and then, of course, in the Gulf of Maine. So we are looking at a kind of a designation that's different than what's currently being used overall. There are a number of different types of nested spatial considerations, as I mentioned, but one of them will come into play in the use of or thinking about the way we're using different types of large-scale and year-round closure areas. And this is a sort of a catalog of different ones that are now in place for different purposes overall. If we were to adopt this ecosystem-based, spatially-based ecosystem management structure, basically we'd be reevaluating the types of closures that we'd have and actually trying to coordinate them more closely. So, for example, right now we have in closed area one a substantial overlap with the right whale exclusion area. From an ecosystem point of view, it would make no sense actually to think about those two things separately, but rather to have a closed area that met multiple objectives and not be asking fishermen to keep track of all these different purposed closed areas. And similarly, We have a substantial overlap between the Western Gulf of Maine closed area and the Stellwagen Bank area, and it would be really beneficial for us to think about the really important role of the sanctuary overall, both in our understanding processes in the system, but as a potential management structure and really coordinating much more closely than we have in the past in that way. So the next part I'm going to be talking about really deals with the use of a couple types of models, and here I'm only I want to use this somewhat complicated diagram only to show that actually we're looking at a number of different types of modeling approaches at the Northeast Center. When you look at the rectangles down the lower parts, you're looking at classes of models and types of models that we have developed and now have as part of our catalog to use in support of ecosystem-based fishery management. So there are actually quite a number of them. When we get further guidance from the Council and the way it would like to proceed, then we can actually hone in more closely on some of the types of modeling approaches that would be most beneficial to meet those kinds of objectives. But for the meantime, for now, I'm actually just going to show you two as examples. So there are a couple different pathways that we follow through this pathway, some of which deals with looking at energy flow models of this type. And I'm actually going to talk a little bit about this one that says production potential models. There are a number of full ecosystem models, including one very complicated model called Atlantis that Jason Link and Robert Gamble at our laboratory have developed and implemented for the Northeast Shelf. And then there are a range of different multi-species models that you see more to the right side. And I'm sorry, this pointer is dying on me, so I can't guide you quite, I think, the way I'd like, but there are a number of different types of ecosystem, multi-species models, and I'll be talking about one of them that really corresponds to that community-level model that I indicated really down there at the lower part of the diagram. So the point is we've actually invested in quite a number of different types of modeling approaches to try to hedge our bets and be in a position to help with the kinds of issues that the Council would like to address. I'm going to give you just a couple of examples, some of which you've seen before from presentations that I've made. But one is this idea of, and among the more simple models that we're looking at, is this idea of looking at fishery production potential, where we're tracing energy flow from the base of the food web here, where we have these phytoplankton cells up to zooplankton that feed on the phytoplankton, forage fish, piscivores like this bluefish, higher-level apex predators like this shark, and so on. And we can trace the flow of energy once we get an idea of what's coming in at the base of the food web. So the simple way of plotting that kind of calculation that we're dealing with here sort of goes something like this. It's a little bit more complicated than what I just showed in the sense that there's two size classes of these microscopic plants that are so important in terms of the productivity in the system. And there are a couple types of zooplankton, one small microzooplankton that are preying on the smaller phytoplankton and larger zooplankton that prey on the larger or graze on the larger phytoplankton. Bivalves, scallops, ocean coags, surf clams also directly take advantage of the larger phytoplankton resource. And then it goes up through the food web, or here we've all collapsed it into a food chain in terms of the planktivores, herring, mackerel, and other species that are preying principally on plankton of different types, and then up to the higher trophic levels, and then we're extracting catch. Now, we have other variants on this theme that go up to as many as 36 different boxes, but this is the simpler one, and a simple one, and it gives you an idea of the basic idea of tracing energy flow through a system. And we're able to do that in a number of different ways. One, in terms of the information that comes in at the base of the food web, we're now extracting information from satellites, and that's what's represented in this upper panel, that allow us to estimate the production of these plants at the base of the food web. If we're going to follow that kind of flow diagram that I just showed you a moment ago, we're also going to need to know what the transfer efficiencies are, how much energy goes from one step in each of those levels that I showed you along the way, and we have been able to estimate those in a number of different ways and bring that into play in the calculations. And then finally, we won't need to make decisions about what levels we're extracting the prey from the the fishery resources from the bivalves to the planktivores to the higher trophic levels. And this plot basically shows you that that's changed over time, where in the early 60s we're extracting much of our catch from the upper trophic levels, and now other parts of the system are much more important in terms of what we're extracting. So when we actually specify where we're going to take things out, and more importantly, in a more prospective way, what we'd like to have and see what the catch composition is, we have ways of understanding that directly and taking it into account. We can put these into relatively simple models and also take into account the uncertainty. And here I'm actually showing a probability distribution of the fishery production potential under our current environmental conditions in this lower panel here, whether you see the histogram. And it's basically saying the modal level, or the median level, I should say, of the fishery production potential on George's Bank, this calculation I'm showing is for George's, is on the order of 900,000 metric tons. So we'll need next to define a safe extraction part to this story in order to get what our expected catch levels would be under this kind of production potential. And that, of course, would be up to the decision made by the council. But we would recognize from some fundamental ecological principles that we wouldn't want to let that number exceed about a third of that overall production potential, because that's really the new production that's coming into the system on an ongoing basis, based on some other calculations that we've done. So there's that kind of that would be a maximum level that we talk about extraction in terms of the production, removal of production from the system as catch. I'm going to next turn to a number of different types of aggregate models. You saw the first one, of course, when I introduced the idea that the International Commission for Northwest Atlantic Fisheries had, in fact, implemented a policy based on aggregate production. But one of the things I want to point out is that we find here, again, we're looking at information for George's Bank, and we're looking at it for a number of different species groups, including the cod-like fishes, the gadids, flatfish, other groundfish, skates, pelagic fishes, and then a total. And there's one recurrent theme that comes about. These data come from our trawl surveys. There's one recurrent theme that we see with this kind of information, and it's that the whole is much more stable than the parts, and it's much more predictable than the parts. So even though we've got a lot of interactions going on among the parts of the system, this seems to indicate that, one, there are some constraints overall in the amount of energy that's coming into the system that we can use and that supports the production of, in this case, the fish community on George's Bank, and that if we aim our management efforts at these higher levels of ecological organization, then we might have a good chance of having, again, more stability and predictability. In saying that, what I'm emphatically not saying is that we can ignore individual species. We always want to keep our finger through our trawl surveys and other sources on the changes on the individual species, and also, as you'll see later on as we go on in the presentation, to put controls on in the system that actually would recognize that we do need to protect individual species overall. But there's a really striking ecological fact that there's a much more stability at the system at higher levels of ecological organization than there are when we look at the component parts. So this is another flavor of aggregate production model. Here, though, this one actually, again, we're looking at data for George's Bank, and same kind of production curve that we've been talking about overall. In this particular case, it's a model that's dealing with 21 of the dominant species on George's Bank, and it's also taking into account the size composition of those species and the nature of the interactions among them. So it's a full multi-species model that we're looking at. But here, what we're picturing is rather the results for the individual species, the total, the multi-species maximum sustainable yield in particular for the system in that dome-shaped curve. And it turns out for this set of calculations that the maximum sustainable yield, multi-species maximum sustainable yield for the system would occur at an exploitation rate of about 0.44. But the other thing that we're really interested in keeping track of what's going on with the individual species, and this is why I say we really need to make sure that we don't ignore those, is this curve, this step curve, which actually shows how many species, as we increase the exploitation rate, are dropping below 10% of their maximum values over time. And you can see that that increases fairly steadily as we go along. But if we were to take this reference point of 0.44, which, you know, in conventional fisheries management would, in fact, of course, be a limit reference point, not a target, but at that limit reference point, nearly 40% of the populations that we're looking at here would be considered collapsed under this definition of being below 10% of their maximum value. So it's really there. This is if we were to attempt to extract the maximum yield from the system in that sense for this 21 species complex, actually we'd be exacting a very high toll on the ecological structure of the system. However, if we were to just drop it back to an exploitation rate of 0.2 and move up follow here, now we're actually getting almost 90% of the yield in this model that we would have projected under the limit reference point, but less than 10% of the species are now in that trouble area. So there's a real benefit in terms of preserving ecological structure and thinking about taking a much more precautionary approach to management. And, of course, you're getting almost all the yield, spending less to get it overall in terms of the way the fishery is operating overall. And it's those kind of win-win situations that we'd really be looking at in terms of moving towards ecosystem-based fishery management. So here now, this is a translation to a reference point that's very familiar to you. You can frame it in terms of either a fishing mortality rate or an exploitation rate, providing some target level of yield. In this case here, we're looking at one where we have a dual objective of trying to get reasonable catches while also minimizing the impact on the structure of the system overall. If we were to take this more aggregate approach, of course, we would need to determine how we're going to split the catches among individual species because, of course, we all recognize that although I might tell you that there's a species group that you could be interested in as a management entity, the components of that assemblage of fish are likely to have quite different values in the marketplace. They're also likely to have quite different vulnerabilities to harvesting, and we need to take that directly into account. So basically, here we need to find out, devise a strategy to determine how much of the total production we can safely extract from the system as a whole, and then allocate total catches according to the species and the fishery, and to do it in a way where we don't exceed some total safe level of catch from the system as a whole, and ensure that none of the individual species are driven to low levels. There are actually some pretty straightforward analytical ways, the optimization methods that would allow us to put those kinds of constraints in place. We've had experience in doing this earlier in the Northeast Center and trying to look under that same ICNAF management strategy that I mentioned before and actually following this kind of an approach where we can try to make sure that we have a safe extraction policy but we don't really disrupt the underlying and fundamental structure of the system. So one of the ways we're thinking about this allocation strategy in particular is to specify what we're calling a ceiling or specify a constraint on total removals, and that is, in fact, what was done under ICNAF. It's also currently being done in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea as a strategy, an ecosystem-based management strategy. So an issue that actually has precedent here in the Northeast, and it's also currently being applied in other areas. This bit that says species biomass limits or floors, that's the part where we say we actually can devise this optimization problem in a way that we make sure that nothing gets driven below these critical levels for the individual species. And currently, under our current law, of course, that would mean that none of them could be driven below a reference point that's related to the biomass at maximum sustainable yield for that species. There are also quite explicit economic and social objectives that we could take directly into account. And again, as we get more guidance from the social science community and also through feedback with stakeholder groups involved in the council process, we'll have a clear idea of what that could look like. Also folded into this process is this idea of considering directly ecosystem needs, including the role of forage fish in the system and habitat protection, as just two examples among many that we could actually bring into this. And there may well be different tools that would come into play, as you'll see in a moment, that could be most effective in different parts of that story. And then finally, it's an optimization problem. It's come some sort of a mathematical programming problem, as it's called, to say what we'd actually do in terms of setting something that actually could be framed in terms of sectors and catch shares if that were the desirable course of action by the council. This idea of identifying the trade-offs and more particularly reconciling the trade-offs is really a critical issue and perhaps one of the more thorny ones that we'll have to deal with in this overall process, because basically we need to recognize in ways that we currently do not that we've got interactions among these species that means that, from our analyses, that we actually can't have them all simultaneously at maximum sustainable yield or biomass at maximum sustainable yield levels overall. And we also need to recognize, for example, that we've got species that through predator-prey interactions, when we take one action that affects the predator, for example, it will have knock-on effects on the prey and vice versa. So that occurs now, but we actually don't explicitly acknowledge it in current management. So we're trying to actually optimize in terms of the extraction policies on a single stock basis in ways that have indirect effects that we're not currently taking into account. So the key issue in terms of identifying these trade-offs is to actually specify what we'd like to have for management strategy in the system and then devise the appropriate fishery management policies accordingly. In terms of the tools that we'd use for the job, of course, they're the same basic tools that we have for conventional management, but very often with quite different objectives. We have a set of, in the toolkit, issues that relate to effort limitation, gear modifications or conservation engineering, the use of time or area closures, and output controls of total allowable catches. Once we have objectives clearly specified, we'll see that the weight that we might attach to different and the utility of different management strategies that we might imply or tools that we'd apply to the problem really could differ relative to what we're currently doing now, where we're trying to meet our single species and stock objectives overall. It's all very doable, but it will really hinge on the choices that are made by the council in how we'd like to move forward. And then finally, the eighth step is to make sure that we continually evaluate the outcomes. Ask the question, are our objectives being achieved? Do we need to make mid-course corrections? And in particular, because we're dealing with complex systems, we need to really recognize that the price of living in this complex world is really sustained and careful monitoring to detect problems that might emerge and to take actions that would be required in order to move past those problems. I'll close with a couple of comments. As I mentioned, one thing that we're really trying to do now is to move forward with a fuller integration of the social and natural sciences. Next week in Woods Hole, there'll be a meeting of social scientists who are beginning to work together in terms of framing an approach to the what we'll call the human dimensions aspect of the problem through one of our NOAA cooperative agreements. So this is an important issue, and you know, too, that the next main topic area for the nationwide SSC meeting to be held in Virginia is really going to focus on a lot of the social issues and economic issues that are so important in the fisheries and in particular in ecosystem-based fishery management. But we'll need much more information and data from our social science colleagues and to work closely with the integration of that information into the management strategies. Another part of this human dimension is a greater participation in decision making, looking at how we really deal with the issues of fishery trade-offs, how do we take advantage of factors such as co-management with aspects of the industry to get the benefit of the perspectives from industry and others in terms of framing a viable ecosystem-based fishery management approach. It will involve some potential changes in our current council institutions. This is a representation of some of the main elements of what we currently have in place, including things such as the plan development teams that are so important, the role of the SSCs and so on, and the advisory processes that come about through stock assessment workshops. But under ecosystem-based fishery management, now we'll be shifting our perspective to one that's really focusing on planning for ecological spatial management structures in general. Perhaps if the council were to be interested in Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank ecological production units as potential spatial management areas, we would need close coordination with the existing PDTs and bring them into and gain from their perspective on the ecosystem-based fishery management plan development overall. And then actually to ensure that we've got important communication among the different PDT groups that might be involved within an ecological production unit, really, and to benefit from their experience. One thing we don't want to do is to lose the important benefits that have come both from the intensive analyses that we have under our current management and its successes in bringing back a number of the stocks that we're dealing with. So we need to really deal quite specifically with ensuring that through this communication process that we bring in the expertise that we currently have and the benefits from what the council has achieved into this overall process. One of the things that will become important for the SSC is greater consideration of the social and economic issues, and we have been fortunate to add to the SSC a number of social scientists recently that will help in that process. Finally, we'll just mention that we'll need the equivalent of a stock assessment workshop process, but one that's really aimed quite specifically at evaluating the types of ecological information that we're currently that we would bring to bear in terms of the development of these ecosystem-based fishery management plans. So there'd be a new sort of review process that would come into play. I will mention that that we recently did have a successful peer review of the modeling activities that we've been working on in support of ecosystem-based fishery management as an initial stage in this process. The next part will really be when we come to the council with guidance on what you would like to achieve in terms of the actual strategies and the actual numbers that would come into play to support the process. And that will, again, require a review process that's quite comparable to what we currently have for the single species management structures. For the next steps for the councils, we'll need to implement this consultative process, close coordination with the Mid-Atlantic Council and, of course, the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission with New England Council will be absolutely critical, and we've been trying through the work that we've been doing at the center to try to make sure that there's full communication of what we've been working on in this way and how it might relate to considerations both by the Mid-Atlantic Council and the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. The PDTs will have to help us outline the EBFM plan requirements and develop appropriate structures that are really centered on these ecological production units that I've been talking about overall. Next steps that we see for the SSC itself is to develop a white paper on social and economic analyses required for ecosystem-based fishery management, and then continue this ongoing dialogue with the center, the council staff on stock assessment and ecosystem assessment activities that would become critical in developing the next steps. You'll see that we've actually have made some attempts at defining these ecological production units for your consideration. At the last meeting, I showed how those map to different human use patterns, but particularly different fishery sector patterns. So you can refer back to that information if it would be useful. We need to identify a set of priorities and services associated with each of these production units. To the extent that it's we'd really need to define the ecosystem-based fishery management objectives for these production units and also define a risk management strategy overall in terms of dealing with that. Again, we'd select the tools and the management strategies to achieve our objectives, and then develop a reporting structure and ongoing activity to monitor progress to our overall towards our overall EBFM objectives. I'll just close by saying that on our center website, we've tried to make available to you quite a bit of information on what we have been doing in terms of ecosystem processes in the Northeast. So it'll give you a fuller idea beyond anything I could have gone into today. If you just look at this URL or Google NEFSC Ecosys, it'll take you right to this page, and you'll find that we've tried to provide a lot of information for you as background information, so you'll understand what we actually have to work with in terms of information in this context. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, we're actually developing a number of different attempts to help with this issue of defining coastal marine spatial planning and impacts of some of the types of activities that have been proposed, most particularly wind farm activities. And we're putting it in a both in terms of more conventional GIS framework, but also a Google Oceans application that you'll soon be able to download, and you can zoom in on different parts of the shelf and look at different kinds of impacts and activities there. So I'll close with that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your attention, and ask if I can answer any questions.
Paul Howard.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Mike. As you know, the council and the industry has had a very, very smooth transition going from input controls to catch shares. It's been very smooth, no lawsuits or everything. And so the biggest thing that hits me with this transition mm-hmm. is it's huge. It's really a sea change. We're going mm-hmm. through one now, mm-hmm. and to have another one right on top of it.
Yeah.
And so I'm concerned about the resources, time, people, budget, to do something like this. I clearly see the management benefits. Mm-hmm. I think we have to engage our stakeholders to see what's in it for fishermen, because that's where the rubber meets the road. So we know a lot what's in it for management. We need to find out, to tell the story, what's in it for fishermen, too.
Mm-hmm.
Resources are huge. We're now going to, with a budget going down, I think we'd have to assess by ecosystem instead of assessing, you know, the range of the stock. Look at every unit, every fish within that ecosystem, and start tracking the health of that instead of the whole thing, and probably do both. So I think it's mm-hmm. really huge, very important to do and move in that direction. So I think as we look at the next steps, I think we have to look at where we are now with catch shares. Is that a part of moving towards this?
Mm-hmm.
And what can we do over the next 3 to 5 years to put us in a position to get where we might want to go? I don't think this mm-hmm. is something that, you know, is going to happen like catch shares is now.
Mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
we really got to make sure we have the resources to do this at a time when resources are getting very scarce. And the other thing is, I think we need to engage the industry. What's in it for them in addition mm-hmm. to what's in it for management?
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Those are important points. So a couple responses. I think one important one is that when I talk to fishermen about this, there is a great deal of interest in the sense that, you know, fishermen are good naturalists. To be a good fisherman, you need to be a good ecologist, essentially. And they see things changing, and they wonder why we're not fully taking them into account. And so I think there's a comfort. My understanding in talking to folks is that there is a comfort level with the idea of actually trying to bring these things into play and actually trying to find a way that's tractable and doable under the constraints that you're talking about. So that's really what our group has really been focusing on trying to do. So I think a benefit of this overall is to develop an approach that's more realistic, that takes into account more of the changes that people see And we are in a changing environment. You know, there are a number of important climate changes that we're going to be facing and have faced in the recent past that we need to take into account. So I think there is that interest on the part of folks in the industry that I've been able to talk to that is interested in seeing where this would lead. I'll also have to be honest that a lot of people are afraid that it simply means more regulation. And what we're trying to think about is how do we deal with this in a way that preserves ecological integrity but simplifies, not makes more complicated, the management. And we're dealing right now in a very complex management environment. And folks in the industry have to contend with a lot of different types of management considerations. Here we'd be simplifying in the sense that, one, we'd be dealing with management strategies that really aimed at these ecoregions rather than the individual species overall. You're right to say we still need to take into account and keep track of these individual species, and I mentioned that as well. But we already have in place the mechanisms to do that. So we're not talking about a change or an increase in terms of the monitoring responsibilities in that sense. So we would fully intend to keep that in play. But I think, you know, it's a fundamental issue in terms of moving forward with this, and can we actually do it? My group has, for the last couple of years, devoted full time to trying to understand how we could actually make this workable. And what I would propose is that I think part of what you're saying is that demands on council staff are such that being able to move forward without some pretty substantial help would be difficult. And what I'm offering is the services of my entire group in order to make that happen. I don't want to pretend that it would be simple or easy, but we've actually assembled a lot of the information. And if you do have the opportunity to go to this website, you'll see just how much information is available to help with this. We could, in a very reasonable period of time, provide, based on the information we have already assembled, the kinds of background documentation about key ecosystem processes that you would need to consider as a starting point for discussion about what the council would like to do. So in any new things, it's an evolutionary process. So I don't mean to suggest that the first steps that any of the councils will take will be full-blown and fully fleshed out. We'll move forward. But I think that some of the ways we've tried to actually simplify the problem, whether it's in terms of reducing the number of overall management plans we're dealing with, or asking the question, how can we actually focus our attention at levels of ecological organization that give us more stability and predictability, are ways that could make it viable. But it definitely involves thinking outside the box. And this is exactly the reason why I'm not suggesting that we take our existing management plans and think we can tack on all kinds of ecological considerations to them and that we're going to model every part of the system, because there's a point where you just they're rapidly diminishing returns and trying to follow that strategy. So I can't say we've thought as carefully as we could about how to make it viable, and we'd basically ask you for the chance to show that we can provide a viable option and do it in a way that, you know, you wouldn't have to adopt until you were comfortable with what you have to look at, basically.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mike. As always, a very informative presentation. I have one specific question and one sort of more global comment observation. On that slide, I think it was number 4, that showed the ecological productivity.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you be at about 0.25? Just don't you want to go as far over till that line goes up, so that you're increasing the overall output, but you're not increasing the collapse line? I mean, in theory,
yeah. I mean,
do I have that correct?
Basically, again, it would be a decision that the council would take, Rip, on the levels of risk that you'd want to assume. And here the risk would involve, this is the one you mean, right? This figure?
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, the choice of how far, where you would, whoops, excuse me, where how far you'd go to the left here would be a consideration based on the potential impact on the ecological structure on the one hand and the change in yield overall. And so I think, and again, one of the important things I think about having the social scientists, and in particular in this case, resource economists involved, is they could actually, it probably would make a lot more sense for us to frame this in terms of dollars, in terms of profit margins, than necessarily just the catches. But, yeah, you're right. You could consider a range. Basically, you know, not unlike what we currently do, and we talked about in the SSC meeting or discussion yesterday about, you know, different levels of risk as you change, you know, the extraction policy. We could do the same thing and try to find the right level overall. But one thing I'd like to say, I mean, this part about making sure we really minimize the impact on the species is quite critical from a number of different ways, and it relates to an issue that you could think about. Let me go back to this one. One way you can think about what we're talking about here is just in the way in financial circles you think about managing a portfolio and taking advantage of something like a mutual fund where you've got a diversity maintained in that portfolio. We're saying that there's a real advantage in maintaining the diversity in the ecological portfolio that you'd be managing. And it really would, in particular, if we're dealing with shifting environmental conditions, maintaining that full diversity gives us an insurance policy in the future. And that's really essentially what you do in financial portfolio theory. And we'd be talking about the same thing. So this is another way of getting at this question of risk. But you're right to say that you could consider, I mentioned the level of 0.2, and you could do a full analysis of what the implications overall would be in terms of 0.25 or any other number. And that would be the way to approach this, actually. So.
And maybe I was misinterpreting the importance of the percentage of those that are collapsed. It seemed like you were on that line anyway.
Yeah. So. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah.
You can push that out to where, just to where they increase, yep. And mm-hmm. you're increasing yeah. your yield out of that. That's all.
Yeah, that's a good point. I will say in that regard that one of the things that. This step pattern really, of course, as you think about, is a consequence of the number of individual species we have. And, you know, if we did this for 40 species, which the council may want us to do, then you'd have different step patterns and so on. So, yeah. But you're right to say that you could deal with it, you know, strictly from this point of view, as you said, with no loss and moving to a higher level than I suggested.
And my other observation was that in looking at the three units that you have there, it certainly seems that if we go to move in this direction, that there would have to be substantial coordination with the MID, because it would almost seem that essentially we would. If we stuck to those boundaries, we would be changing the areas that we currently have management jurisdiction over. Mm-hmm. But so it would seem to me that's also a big another big change to add to the list that Paul brought up.
Yeah. Well, maybe one way to think about that potentially is that of course we do have some shared management responsibilities between the two councils now and also, of course, with the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. So in a sense, it's a different flavor of shared responsibility, but one that we definitely could consider. Choosing these boundaries, they're not really, they're emphatically not thinking about some of the, what might others might call political dimensions of this, you know, and all the, you know, from the all the recommendations basically for moving towards ecosystem-based fishery management really say to keep it on an ecological footing in terms of how you define the boundaries. And again, we've been fortunate to be able to have time with both the Mid-Atlantic Council and with the Atlantic States Fisheries Commission to work carefully and keep them apprised of what we're doing. And Jason Link is working with the Mid-Atlantic Council on their scientific and statistical committee and leading an effort, a subgroup of that committee, to look at these issues. So you really put your finger on a really critical issue, is the coordination among the different groups and different management authorities.
Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mike. A lot of value here. We've known for a long time, and nobody today in the fishing community has any doubt but that single species management has failed us and will continue to fail us, and will fail us worse as time goes on. It's been a long time. We've known that we're going to have to somehow move in the direction of ecosystem management. But we've been like Frodo, you know, when he was when he said to Gandalf, "I know what I must do. I just don't know if I can do it." And that's been really where we've been for a long time. Mm-hmm. The problem has been that in doing it, it seems like you have to make this enormous radical change. And how do you set a date and then say, "Okay, from this date we're going to have a new plan in place, and everything's going to get blown up." And that's just not going to be acceptable. Everybody knows that's not acceptable. So the strength in your approach here is that I see three things that are really much different in the way you're approaching this. And it boils down to the fact that, first of all, you've specifically stressed the point that humans are components of the ecosystem. That isn't always made clear by people who talk about ecosystem management. Too often we think of the ecosystem as being something outside of humans, and you've been very clear on that point, that we're concerned with the ecosystem as with humans as a part of it. And the other thing is, instead of offering the usual platitudes you hear from people who want to go that way, you've actually offered a plan, and that's a new thing, a plan rather than platitudes. And the other thing is that in the conversion, your plan provides us with a way to do this as an evolution instead of a revolution, and I find these to be the compelling things that make me think that finally it's time to go ahead and move and get this done. Let's do it.
Thank you, David. I appreciate those sentiments.
Next, I had Vince, then Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Fogarty. I'm glad you're towards the front of your presentation. I'm wondering, could you go to the slide where you said one of the advantages was the management coordination becomes simpler?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Like number three?
Yeah. Sorry, Vince, I'll get there. Is that the one?
Simplification of management structures and coordination of management activities, actions. And I, you know, was thinking probably along the same lines as Captain Howard, is, you know, you mentioned Mid-Atlantic and the Commission and the New England Council. I was wondering, it's not intuitively obvious to me why things would become more straightforward and simpler. And I'm wondering if you could maybe walk through an example of how you envision it, something like this working, if you would, please.
Right. Thanks, Vince. It is an important point, and I'd be happy to try to emphasize what I think is some of the key issues. One is this basic idea of there's a real cost, I think, in us maintaining several dozen management plans in place. And when we take the councils and the commission into account, we've got about three dozen by my count. And so that means that there's a lot of overall activity in terms of supporting those plans, but particularly an issue that relates to because of the level of effort in thinking about it in that way, a lack of full coordination among the plans themselves. And that comes at a real cost, I think, a real potential cost, in the sense that there are a lot of things that can fall through the cracks in terms of thinking about how there actually are interactions. And when we make an action in one plan, it has knock-on effects on others, but we don't recognize that and we don't take it into account. So if we thought about it from the start, from a more holistic way, one, I think we'd be packaging everything in one place where we can make sure that we don't let things fall through the cracks, and also that we really take advantage of the full set of information that we have on how these systems operate. So this one of the issues in simplicity, I think, is simply dealing with a smaller number of plans, but also ones that are more comprehensive. And that in and of itself would come at more cost. It would be more complex, of course. But so that's why we're asking the question, can we think about different ways of thinking about how the ecosystem works itself and bring that as part of the management process, rather than saying, again, what I'm emphatically not saying is that I personally feel that it'd be a path to failure if we pretended we needed to know everything about every species, every impact of different environmental influences on those species, and the whole set of considerations that would come. It's an immense problem, but one that basically is both probably not tractable if we want to get reasonable predictive advice to the councils, and also doesn't take into account necessarily the full power of thinking about this as an ecosystem, and as I tried to show, the greater stability that an ecosystem has relative to the parts. So one way that it would differ is we'd not be saying necessarily that you know we can keep each species at some specified target level, but rather recognize that things are constantly changing. We want to keep them in a safe bound and actually explicitly take into account the fact that what, effect on one species is going to affect others in the system. So it's trying to take advantage of those kinds of properties of an ecosystem that are different and from the parts, basically, and also try to take into account the simplicity of having fewer plans where you can actually have better coordination among them.
So, thank you. That's helpful. So then what it seems to me that the challenge here is going to be the credibility of the linkage in getting all of the stakeholders and the managers and the scientists all on the same page as what the linkage is. Mm-hmm. And this is in an environment where right now we can't get, quite frankly, the harvesters and the scientists on the same page as what the linkage is to their activities. But we're going to say, for example, that you can't take as many codfish as you want because something else is eating them, and we can prove that linkage, therefore you don't have them, and vice versa. And mm-hmm. I think that's going to be a significant lift.
Well, I think in general, as I tried to say earlier, if what we're saying is more resonant with what fishermen actually see and actually feel about how these systems operate, then we have a chance of making this work. And I think that's really what we're striving for. And, as I said, fishermen are good ecologists. And we want to take advantage of that knowledge, that ecological knowledge that they have, and also share what we think we understand about the system. And, that whole website that I talked about is really dedicated to trying to do that, to provide that part of the story from our own, from the work that we've done, and bring that to bear on how people think about the system and how it's changing and what we could might be able to do about it. I think you're right, and I don't mean to in any way imply that it's a simple problem, but I'd like to believe that it's an approach that's more consistent with the way people actually see things in the ocean, and that's what we'd be trying to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Vince.
Rick Robbins. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Dr. Fogarty pointed out, we have formed an ecosystem subcommittee on our SSC
Jason Link, who's here today, is heading that effort up for us. And we've given them terms of reference that are both short-term and long-term in nature. So we've asked them to provide us with technical advice that would aid in the development of ecosystem-level goals and objectives. We've also asked them to provide us with advice that would facilitate better incorporating ecological considerations into our decision-making processes. These are the short-term things that we're focused on over the course of the next year, and I think that's an area where we can make incremental progress. But as Vince points out, there's often such disparity between the different stakeholders and constituents on this question that I think the process by which the goals are developed is going to be very, very critical to the outcome and to the success of making progress. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the areas where we'll be working with the committee to try to lay out and develop an iterative process whereby the SSC provides us with technical advice, the council can consider that, and then bring in stakeholder input as we go along through the process in order to try to develop those goals and objectives. But this longer-term question about going to more of a place-based management model, to me, is a much more fundamental change and departure from how we're doing business now. And I think making progress either incrementally or in the longer term is going to require very considerable coordination across the different management bodies.
Yeah. Thanks, Rick. That's a really important point. There's two issues, and one of which I want to turn back to part of the question that Paul asked me, which in my advanced state of senility I didn't really address. So I'll try to fold it into what part of what I think is important with this one, Rick. And you're quite right to say that, you know, going to the area-based management strategy is a pretty big sea change, and that point I think has been made a number of times, and it's quite true. But I think we really need to recognize that under the National Ocean Policy, this is going to happen. So what I'm not here to do is to advocate an approach. I'm trying to let you know that this is going to happen, and it's going to happen faster than I think any of us had really anticipated, and it's going to be driven by these external considerations with respect to wind. So part of the reason we're trying to prepare ourselves for this is a recognition that it's not just a strategy that we've come up with, but it's a policy that's been put forward by the president in his executive order, and that it really will happen. So we need to be ready for it, and the sooner we're ready for trying to move in this direction, the less the chance we get steamrolled by other ocean use sectors in trying to move forward. The part that I neglected, that's part of the answer that I should have given to what Paul asked me earlier, but the other part of it is that you asked whether sectors and cat shares could be part of this, because you've invested so much to get there, and it has been a painful process. And the short answer is yes, and we've been trying to we can frame the kind of ecosystem advice that we could give you in a way that's fully consistent with those kinds of approaches. And basically, if the last time I spoke, I showed you some examples of mapping where the sectors operate relative to where we are currently proposing for potential management units. And sorry about this. And so we've been careful. The point I want to make is that we've been careful to try to understand, well, what would be the implications for the kinds of things that we're suggesting with all the effort that you've put into making these. And I think, you know, one of the really attractive things about, I know the issue of sectors has been totally wrapped up with also the allocation issue, but I mean, one of the really interesting things about the way the sectors have been operating, I think, is as cooperatives. In the fullest sense, they really can share information and the knowledge that folks in the industry have in terms of attacking problems together and helping the managers attack them is a really powerful thing. So we've been trying to understand, you know, how what we're talking about might relate. So I'll just give you two examples here. This is from prior fishing history, at least, where the vessels in the Port Clyde sector have been operating in relation to the boundaries we're talking about. And this one is one near and dear to John. where the sectors for the fixed gear sector have been operating. And although I'm not sure you can clearly see it in the back, but, you know, of course, in all of these, the warmer colors are the higher activity areas overall. And there's a really interesting relationship between that really hot spot area in the fixed gear sectors and the boundaries that we're talking about in terms of these ecological production units that I interpret as saying that the fishermen are picking up on a lot of the same patterns that we are in terms of what's important in terms of the way things in the ocean are operating. So anyways, Paul, I should have really fully answered your question, and I'm sorry that I didn't, but to think about this just moving after you've gone through such a radical transformation, I know is hard to contemplate. And there are important ways and important reasons for thinking about what we're talking about in relation to what you have accomplished.
Dave Pierce, then Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Once again, very comprehensive, very ambitious work that's being planned, and I agree with you, there is no choice in the matter. This is going to happen, marine spatial planning, and this is a tool by which this council can be more involved in marine spatial planning. Very supportive of the effort, especially because you have devoted your staff to this initiative, a staff that has great expertise and capability, and because of that, I know that this effort will involve a close look at, the consideration of the gadded cod, paddock, et cetera, the gadded versus the elasmobranch relationship, dogfish, skates, the gadded versus the pelagic relationships, you know, mackerel and herring, relationships that I've always found to be rather fascinating, and of course I always reflect back on comments made by the center years ago that you can't rebuild groundfish if you let elasmobranchs run wild, and pelagics have an impact on gadded success as well. So that'll be extremely instructive because there'll be, I suspect, more information brought forward regarding those relationships and how they factor into ecosystem-based fisheries management. In addition, seals, marine mammals. What about the seals? A lot of work has been done at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. I want that to be pulled out of the center and used through your group so we can get a better feel for what this phenomenal growth in seal population in New England is having on our ability to rebuild and maintain these stocks. So very glad it's moving forward for that reason alone. More information about these key relationships. Question, you indicated in your presentation that an element, one of the steps in the process is to estimate the fishery production potential. And I just need to make sure that I'm understanding you correctly. You said in your presentation that we can determine how much fish and shellfish an ecological region can produce based on how much food comes in at the base of the food web and how energy is transferred from one level to the next in the web. This will vary with environmental and climatic conditions. So your group will actually be able to provide us with that kind of insight and actually will have that kind of data to plug into the model to come up with those sorts of projections, I assume?
We are doing that now, David, and have been in, as I mentioned, a couple different types of models. We're fortunate to have be able to extract information that comes from satellites, but also from shipboard operations. But also importantly, we're also trying to take into account the uncertainty of the inputs that come in. And as you know from stock assessment processes and others, there are always uncertainties that come in and that we need to take into account that feed ultimately into risk evaluations. And so we're also trying to account for the uncertainties in these kinds of models that I'm mentioning. And I gave one example where there was a probability distribution of the production potential for Georgia's Bank that tried to account for those levels of uncertainty in it. But yeah, it is true that we have information in terms of the amount of primary production that's coming in at the base of the food web that we can take advantage of. And that's now being calibrated. The information from the satellites is being calibrated against information that come from shipboard operations and so on. So we are trying to take full advantage of that approach. So then that would be one that you'd think about as a whole ecosystem approach, starting right at the very base of the food web. But I also gave examples of what would happen if you looked at these multi-species models. Now, they're not really trying to take into account the production starting really at the base of the food web, but they pick up the story later on, you know, usually in terms of fish community and the interactions among the fish community. I gave an example of that. There'd be similar consideration you'd have for benthic communities, including scallops and other species that are of economic interest that you could develop. So you could try to approach, in that case, you know, focus on more closely on just a part of the system. And we have been working on a number of different models to try to allow us to do that too. So,
yeah, thank you. It's already been my final point is, it's already been alluded to, but it's going to be very important, and that is part of the list of next steps to be taken. Your group certainly is going to have to interact with the councils and with the other elements of the service, the higher-ups within Washington, D.C., well, Silver Springs especially, to begin the process of planning for some revisions to the Magnuson Act, changes in the National Standard Number 1 guidelines. This has to be done early on. This has to be done in anticipation of what's coming out of your shop, what will be, what we'll have to face through marine spatial planning and the President's executive order. That has to be done in a very creative way and very quickly. Otherwise, we'll find ourselves with an approach that we will adopt and we won't be able to implement it. We'll be crippled because of the Magnuson Act as it stands now. So this all has to be part of the planning process, and it's going to take a lot of creativity and a lot of thoughtful people working on this for, I suspect, more than a few weeks. Okay, thanks.
Dave Gaffel.
Hi, Mike. This has been interesting, the whole three presentations. Going into this, I had always thought that the biology aspect was going to be the difficult part. I mean, maybe that's because I'm a biologist and I just had a hard time figuring out how I was going to make the transition from single species to ecosystem management. And you've laid out today, you know, I'm sure it's not going to be more difficult than it appears on paper, but the biology doesn't appear to be the insurmountable part now. It appears doable. But what struck me from listening to everybody around the table here is most of the questions haven't been about how do you do the biology. It's been how do you do the management. And if you go to your third slide, which is what is ecosystem-based management, you have highlighted the words specified geographically. I think I would highlight the four words in front of it, management that is adaptive. I went to a seminar on adaptive management this past weekend, and it was very interesting, but it was kind of like watching people in a 10-step program. You know, hi, I'm Joe from the Army Corps of Engineers, and this is how we do an adaptive management now in a post-Katrina world. You know, hi, I'm Rick from the Department of Interior, and, you know, and they recite how they've changed their management practices to go to a more bottoms-up, adaptable system that will change based on changing conditions. And, you know, interestingly, there was nobody there from NOAA or the National Marine Fisheries Service because they haven't taken the first step in the 10 steps yet.
We have admitted we have a problem.
Yeah. Houston, we got a big one. I would suggest based on what we've heard here today, I know there's only three presentations, but I think we need a fourth one. And the fourth presentation we need is how are we going to change the management system to do adaptive management so that we can do ecosystem-based management? Because we don't, this is a top-down organization now. It's not a bottom-up. And I know people may disagree with me, but I really think that's the way it is. I mean, in addition to what David said about changing the Magnuson Act and the National Standard Guidelines, from the questions around the table, it's very apparent here that you know, getting these various management bodies to interact with each other in an adaptive way and getting the, you know, all the different cogs in place and not having legal impediments where somebody stands up at the 11th hour and says, no, you can't do that, you don't have a mixed stock exception, is not going to work. So, you know, I think that the next thing we need to do now is have another presentation from the folks at the service, the AFMFC, the council staff, working together to tell us how they're going to do adaptive management to pull this off. Because you've showed us how we can do the biology, so now it's somebody else's turn to show us how we can do the management.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Those are good points. Yeah, part of the bit about adaptive management is this part about, as mentioning, in terms of us keeping our finger on the pulse of how things are changing continually and making corrections if things are not going the way they're predicted to do. And we definitely have view that as a critical part of this and to try to address this very issue you're mentioning. There are other parts about the institutional structures that, you know, could be framed as part of an adaptive process where we need to transition to where we go, want to go. I'm thinking that the next look at the Magnuson-Stevens Act will have to really be carefully framed in terms of the National Ocean Policy, and that's one major difference than what we faced last time. And as I'm sure everyone in the room knows, there was a number of different versions of the last reauthorization package that had different degrees of focus on ecosystem issues per se. And now, because the President has said through the National Ocean Policy that ecosystem-based management is the guiding principle for our ocean and Great Lakes resources overall, that it's going to put a different complexion to how that process will be approached. But it is going to be quite a critical one, and David's right to say it's going to require changes. But I think the forcing mechanism in one way or another is this. The sea change is really in now having a National Ocean Policy that's quite explicit about what its basic tenets are and how we do it, do things. I will say that even under our existing law, there's a lot of latitude under the existing version of the Magnuson-Stevens, that there's a lot of latitude to move towards issues that relate to implementation of ecosystem-based management. And, you know, the basic idea that fundamentally we're talking about managing the fisheries to the net benefit of the nation as a broad overarching vision statement. And really what we're talking about here is very consistent with that. And also, the Magnuson Act talks much more about fisheries than about stocks or species, of course. And, you know, that's more consistent with what we're talking about, too, I think.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to quite let go of the management reins yet. It seems to me that right now we have several different currencies. We've got Days at Sea. We've got ACE. We've got some total quota management species. Seems to me that going in this direction is even more imperative for us to have a uniform currency to be able to manage and to have the different people fishing in the different units able to go back and forth pretty easily. Is that anything that you have given thought to in this whole process?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, so part of the reason that I mentioned that we don't view these areas as closed entities is not only with respect to the oceanography and the ecology of the organisms, but also the way the fleets operate. And one thing we could look to do is, if we're thinking about an area-based plan, basically to try, you know, just try to make the point that diversity is important in terms of the ecology of the system, and maintaining that is a critical thing. You know, you all know that it's no less important in terms of the way the fleets operate and the fisheries operate in terms of maintaining diversity of choices for fishermen to operate. And you're right to say that having, you know, an approach that's consistent among the different areas in terms of the management strategies or the currencies, you know, in terms of whether we're talking about input-output controls or whatever, would be quite important to make sure you could allow that. So I think there are a number of important ways about, I mean, we want to think about, I view part of what you're saying and part of what's being said about management today, these last half hour or so, is that there's an issue of human ecology, and there's an issue of its intersection with what we might call artificially, perhaps, the natural ecology. And we want to find the linkages between those. And there, I do think there are certain principles that we could apply across the board in terms of how you think about how an human ecology fits within this natural order and this natural ecology. And so when we've been thinking about, you know, how this would play out, and in particular, if I understand the thing you're really most important about, interested in terms of these aerial designations, is the idea that, you know, we want things to be able to allow for the common currency, as you frame it, to make sure that there's consistency in the way things are dealt with. And also that wherever possible, within the constraints of meeting our ecosystem objectives, that we're preserving flexibility for the fleets and the fishermen to operate, you know, as part of that ecosystem, because that's exactly what the natural part of the system, the fish themselves and the other organisms in the system do. You know, I mean, maintaining that kind of diversity is important, both on the ecology and the social side.
Paul Howard.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think if you look at that, the roadmap to full EBFM, I think that's a great slide for the council to look at. And I want to get back to, I think, you know, everything right now is going to be about resources. And I would recommend maybe that the council ask its executive committee to work with the Science Center and Pat Kirkle to look at this roadmap, identify the resources that we need to start, you know, resources to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, et cetera. Come back to the council in, say, September with a process. How would we define objectives? By what process? What resources would we need? How would we engage our stakeholders? And then how would we go from 1 to 2? And I think the big thing is to have that identified, that process and resource plan identified in September, so that when we vote in November for priorities, if you want to move forward with this and we don't have any additional resources, you know, we might be able to do set specs and 2 plans and then do this. But I agree with Mike. I think that this is the, you know, it's certainly a high priority in NOAA, ecosystem-based fisheries management. The other councils have been moving in this direction. We're slower than the others. Coastal marine spatial planning is coming. It's here. And I think we have to move forward. But again, we don't have the resources to do it. We have to prioritize. And I think the leadership should work with the other leadership and develop a process and resource plan to move us forward.
Anything further from the council? David?
Well, do you need a motion to do what Paul suggests, or is it just by consensus? Or?
No, I don't think we need a motion for that. Okay. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for your attention and the time that you've given us. I appreciate it.
Harriet?
Harriet Diedrichson. To hear this presentation today brings me almost speechless and depressed. We had, before we moved to what we're doing now, people were diversified in fishing. Myself, my family, we're dragging in the winter, mid-Atlantic to Georges, and scalloping in the summer. People held many permits. You had a flat bottom net, you had a hard bottom net when you were fishing. All of a sudden, they split the fleet. Right now, you're mandated to have all species an optimum yield simultaneously. If I understand Dr. Fogarty right, and with due respect to him, what he's saying now is there's predators, which we know. So if you've got predators, of course, they're eating the other fish. We all know that. I would expect the center would know that. So now what you're mandating right now, from what I can see what he's saying, is not the right approach. He's talking about a new approach. It's going to be one, and we see predators, and it has to balance and all like that. So you can't have them all at optimum yield at one time. There's people with their doctors in marine fisheries that say you can't have all species. Dr. Rothschild testified in Washington, so he signed the paper. You can't have all species at optimum yield at once because the ocean does not have the carrying capacity for that. Mr. Canastra said he's going to be here tomorrow and he's going to show you the yield of yellowtail. They're starving. So when we speak today, and we've heard about the windmills, and we've heard what they're saying in Washington about eco management. Well, they've written books on that in the 50s. My friend who has a doctorate in social scientists, she told me that. And that people are number one. People won't be number one here from what I'm hearing. We're talking about IGNAF. I owned a boat, myself personally, from 68, but my family from the 1905, about my uncle immigrated. And so we're talking not about getting rid of people here. They got three owners up there. That's what I hear here. How many more people are you going to get rid of? That's what I see here. Getting rid of fishing, getting rid of people. More use takes room. Now it's windmills. They're not worrying now about fishing. We've been restricted so much, the fishing people, to meet these mandates of Magnuson and National Marine Fisheries. You don't have the mixed species exemption. But he just said today, we look at it more as fisheries it talks to in Magnuson than it talks of species. That was the argument we had a while ago to ask for the mixed fisheries exemption, but we couldn't get it. We're going in circles. And this, I can see, is talking about getting rid of fishing to a degree of a few companies. Let's put windmills here. Let's put some drilling there. Gas, oil, or whatever. The windmills that they're starting with, gas and oil, that's one thing. You have to be near the source, but windmills, you can be on land, but it's being pushed. And fishing, as I can see it, is not in vogue anymore. They're not worrying about how we're promoting fish. He's talking about hiring social scientists. I would think at this point they would have some social scientists themselves. But I've been down a woods hole, and I've listened to some presentations, and they brought in some people, you know, with all degrees of expertise. A while ago, it was on multi-species. I don't know, about 10 years ago, maybe 9. And they hired them. They paid them. And there's lots of ways to come to a decision. But usually, you speak for the person who pays you when you want a paycheck. And if you're on the grant system, and if you're being paid, you look at a paper and I might see the cup empty and you might see the cup full. This, what I hear today, I see as a disaster. And I see that what I hear today is we can manipulate any rules we have because now this is going to happen, and you have nothing to say about it. So there's no more democracy. It's by decree. It's no more what's good for the nation. I don't care how many social scientists you bring in. There's no way they're going to help people. This is about putting people out of fishing, putting people out of work, putting communities under, further than you have today with the so-called system that is had a fine transition. No, it hasn't. The majority of the people have not accepted it. And as far as I see it, it doesn't even conform to the law, because the word sector now is whatever definition anybody wants to make it. So as an American and as a taxpayer, I'm very upset with what I hear today. And I hope other people, if they hear what I hear, will be as upset and will speak up. Thank you.
Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a quick question to Mike. It seems to me that one of the biggest predators, apex predators in the system, is the fishing fleet. And I'm just wondering, have you guys examined the fishing fleet from the perspective of what it feeds on, in other words, by port? So in other words, can you map out where the Point Judith inshore fleet fishes and what it fishes on? Because that seems to me the how to get to incorporating more of an ecosystem approach.
Yeah, what I can do, Ron, is send you the copy of my presentation last time. But we've done two things. One is to map the distribution of fleet activities by port, year type, and vessel size, and one type of analysis. And now that particular one doesn't deal with the species composition. But in another analysis, and then we've mapped those in relation to these proposed boundary areas, but in another analysis, one of my colleagues, Sean Lucy, and I have done looked at species composition of the catches and the fishing locations and for different gear types. And so, for example, in this one, we talked a little bit earlier in terms of the SASE model, the cluster analysis. We've done the same kind of thing for the fleet compositions, and we've identified 10 separate fleets in terms of where they fish, otter trawl fleets in terms of what they catch and where they operate. So it's getting, and then looked at that in relation to these boundaries. So I think it's trying to get at what you're suggesting.
Oh, see, so that's what I don't quite understand. So now you have a vessel.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take an inshore vessel. I don't want to take something more far ranging. And it has, if it's a ground fish vessel, it has a catch share of different species. And it also has, let's say, it catches monkfish or what have you. So how does an ecosystem approach change what that vessel does? In other words, I don't understand what the goal is here. I'm just losing it because, mm-hmm. Will you tell him to fish someplace else? Will you change his species composition? I mean, what would you do? What's the goal of this approach?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's more to recognize that the species that are in that mix are interacting, both because some of them have biological interactions, predator-prey, or possibly competitive interactions, and also the fact that they're caught together and therefore, have common forcing. So it isn't so much to tell people where to fish, it's to recognize that when we set objectives for management, that we explicitly take into account the fact that you've got interactions among the species that are in that group that you mentioned, and to use that to set what the objectives would be for management.
Okay, so the way I see it, it's not this revolutionary concept which is going to change much other than maybe the ABCs based on input ecological considerations. I mean, I'm a farmer, and on my 20 acres, I make every decision I make about a crop has an ecological component to that decision. Whether I, till up the grass between the raspberries to produce more raspberries and plant greens in there, or whether I leave the grass and graze it with chickens. every decision we make is ecological. So all you're doing here is you're not changing the management process. Everybody's going to get their same quota, operate in the same area. Nothing really changes. What you're changing is how we make the decisions of determining what the quota is and whether one year we're going to decide to harvest more codfish and less shrimp and in another year harvest more shrimp and less codfish. And now the question is, well, how do you allocate that change? In other words, we've allocated to the fleet based on their historic performance, but now we might decide that we want less codfish harvested and more shrimp. What are you going to do? Is the council going to set up a procedure for trading codfish for shrimp catch shares? I mean, it's just a slight modification, I think. It's not some revolutionary major change in what we're doing. That's my only 2 cents. Thank you.
And Ron, you're an American? And you pay your taxes?
Yes, I do, sir.
Okay. So it looks like we'll have another EBFM continuing or discussion in June and work with Paul Howard and other leadership to get moving on what he articulated a little earlier. Mike, I appreciate you coming down again.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman.
And we stand adjourned till 8:30 tomorrow morning. Thank you.